This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. An unlikely story hit the news last year.
Researchers in Virginia Tech's College of Engineering are working on a project for the U.S. Navy that could one day put lifelike autonomous robot jellyfish in waters around the world.
Yes, you heard that right. A robotic jellyfish. It's tempting to think of jellyfish as motionless blobs floating passively with the currents. For all that they're constantly pulsating, it never seems to get them anywhere. But in the past year, we've learned some surprising things about jellyfish motion. For one, that gentle pulsating is actually one of the most efficient means of propulsion used by any animal in the ocean. And it gets better. If you've ever watched a jellyfish swim, and if you haven't, you can on our website, capeandislands.org, you'll notice the outer edge of the bell, that's the round body part, flopping back and forth. It turns out that flexible edge is a feature shared with swimmers and flyers throughout the animal kingdom, including birds' wings and whales' tails. Dr. Jack Costello is high among the scientists we have to thank for these intriguing discoveries. His curiosity about jellyfish dates back to his childhood, and he's spent his entire career, almost 25 years, studying how jellyfish move and eat. He's currently a professor of biology at Providence College and a Whitman visiting investigator at MBL. He joins me now in our Woods Hole studio. Jack Costello, happy St. Patrick's Day, and welcome to Living Lab.
Thanks, Heather. Glad to be here.
Now, you've said that movement is almost a fundamental feature of animals, of being an animal. Now, there are obviously animals that don't move, but why do you think animalness and movement are so closely intertwined in our minds?
It seems to be one of the fundamental characteristics in that animals move from location to location for a variety of reasons, but it's one of the traits of animals that they can seek out and reach resources like food or other animals in ways that other groups cannot. For example, plants that are more fixed in location. So movement has been fundamentally a part of the animal kingdom's organization and plan since the outset, as far as we know.
Now, as I understand it, at one point, jellyfish were actually mistakenly considered to be plants.
Particularly anemones, a group related. They're all cnidarians, and anemones were initially classified as plants. And so once further detail of their internal anatomy became apparent, then those distinctions were lost. It's one of those characteristics that we tend to use external appearance as a way to organize things because it makes sense to us. Sometimes things can look similar but actually be quite different. And that's what we call convergent evolution, where groups have tended to arrive at what look like similar solutions, even though they come from very different backgrounds.
Well, we're going to talk more about convergent evolution later this hour. But first, let's actually talk about what jellyfish, you mentioned the internal anatomy. Jellyfish, of course, are animals, but they're very primitive animals. Do they even have muscles as we would, you know, formal muscles as we think of them?
Well, this is one of the really interesting things to me about jellyfish, in that they have, you might call them a beta version of muscles, in the sense that they have striated fibers, the same as striated muscles of all other animal groups. But they're not organized the same way that other animals are. The fibers, whereas in other animal phyla, muscles actually comprise whole cells and are grouped together. In jellyfish and cnidarians in general, they have striated muscle fibers, but they're part of epithelial cells. So
part of the skin, essentially?
Yeah. I mean, in essence, cnidarians are pretty much epithelial organisms. That is, they have cells that are of a very simple organization, and the muscular fibers are part of skin cells, but they're not organized into whole muscle cells the way they are in other animal phyla. So in other animal phyla, for example, a strong muscle that we think of for weightlifters is comprised of numbers of muscle cells all organized into deep groups of fibers. Jellyfish can't do that. They can only have limited numbers of striated muscle fibers within what are essentially epithelial cells or like our skin cells. Our epithelial cells are our outer layer.
So it's almost like their muscles aren't, they don't have a, you know, one compact, distinct muscle. Their muscles are just kind of distributed throughout
Yes.
their whole being. And how are they controlled? I mean, our brain controls our muscles. What do they have in the way of a nervous system to control their movement?
They have a nervous system and nerve fibers, a nerve net that controls muscular contraction. It's not controlled in the same way that we have a very distinct directionality to our nervous system that that they lack. Okay, so it's they don't have what we would call a brain. They have some areas where there's ganglia that cells come together, but there's not really any brain structure for them. So it's a fundamentally simpler system.
They've got a system that's kind of coordinating these movements so that we get
Yes.
that pulsating, but they're not thinking about it and saying, hey, I should pulse more right now or pulse less.
Right.
It's just kind of constantly happening.
It's very difficult to get inside the brain of a jellyfish if there ever were one. But they do have pacemakers along the bell margin that create the rhythm to those contractions. So there is neuromuscular control with rhythmic control of bell contraction, but no central brain that as we know it.
So, I mean, you've even said that, you know, jellyfish are constantly moving, mm-hmm. but they present this conundrum because they're constantly pulsing and yet going nowhere. So explain that. What are they doing? How is this, you know, what are they doing with that, all that pulsing motion if they're not actually going anywhere?
Okay. Well, you know, I should mention that we group jellyfish into, from an ecological standpoint, into groups that really sit still, sort of like spiders, and leave their tentacles hanging down and wait for things to run into them. We call them ambush predators. And then another group called cruising predators, which are the jellyfish that we typically see. Most of the large jellyfish that are large enough for us to notice are these cruising jellyfish and usually what we call scyphozoans, a group of jellyfish that form the largest members. Okay, and so they are constantly pulsing in that they swim, and from our perspective, they don't swim necessarily to get any place, but they swim because feeding and swimming are essentially the same process for them. As they swim, they move water. When they move water, it brings prey that is in that water to their capture surfaces, and that's how they feed. So they're moving and feeding at the same time. It's sort of, I mean, you might say we breathe constantly. We need air for respiration. Well, their way of capturing food involves constantly bringing fluid to their capture surfaces. So many of them move more or less continuously.
And the shape of the body, I mean, if they were trying to get anywhere, presumably they would have evolved a different body shape that was a bit more hydrodynamic. As it is, they're putting essentially this big flat surface that pretty much stops them from moving no matter how much they pulse.
For organisms swimmers that really want to get from one place to another, you can think of tuna, sharks, barracuda, number of fish, characteristically they're very streamlined. And that reduces drag as they swim. But jellyfish have a very, what we call bluff body or oblate form, that really is a very high resistance form. It's not a great form if you want it to be streamlined and reduce drag, but it's a great form if you want to move a lot of water. And that's what they're very good at, moving water.
So when you say, you know, this made headlines all over the place last fall when you guys had a study that came out saying that this movement of jellyfish is among the most efficient means of propulsion. And yet, of course, as we're just talking about, they're not going anywhere. They're not actually good swimmers in that sense. So what does it mean to be the most efficient means of propulsion?
That estimate really is a description of, we use what is called the cost of transport as a comparison between organisms, and you can actually use it to compare to vehicles. Cost of transport is the amount of energy that it takes to move a given mass a given distance. So it's really how much energy does it take to move that amount of material from here to there. That could apply to a car, an airplane, a jellyfish, a fish, or a horse. So the cost of transport, that is how much energy those muscles use to move that amount of material, is comparatively low for jellyfish, as low as any animal we know of. So that's the basis for the argument that they're the most efficient that we know of.
So it takes very little energy. If you've got a tuna fish that's very hydrodynamic, it's right. moving very quickly, mm-hmm. but it's using, I guess, a lot more energy to do that. I mean, so the jellyfish are just, I guess, very low energy animals, because
yes.
if they had more energy, could they actually be, I guess, propelling themselves, swimming directionally, going much more quickly?
They could, and some do that. That some that are less efficient swimmers, but what we call more proficient swimmers, that is, they're better at getting from one place to another quickly, but much less efficient about doing it. There's a number of trade-offs you can make. And jellyfish have done this, and we see different species have made trade-offs along the spectrum of highly efficient or more proficient. You pay a price for being very fast or proficient. In their case, the ones that are most efficient are, unfortunately, you can't be everything at once, and they're most efficient, but they don't get any place very quickly.
So that when you say they pay a price, what is the price they pay for being a more proficient swimmer, a better swimmer?
Energetically, it costs them more.
So then they're going to have to catch more food, gather more food to actually sustain that.
Exactly. And so they'll often use a different strategy. I mentioned before some of the jellyfish are what we call ambush predators. They sit and wait. They use their tentacles much the same way that a spider uses a web. They deploy, they leave their tentacles out, and they wait for things to run into them. Most of those jellyfish are actually pretty proficient swimmers. When they do swim, they can swim quickly, but they're not swimming constantly to capture prey the way the efficient ones are. Instead, they'll sit and wait in ambush, and they swim rather quickly, but usually to escape a threat, like a fish that preys on them, or
and they
turtle.
Can actually swim fast enough to get away from
some of them are yeah some of them are very quick, extremely quick swimmers. If you try and chase them underwater, they're often much faster than you are. So some of them are quite proficient, very effective swimmers. So it's not as if all jellyfish are these kind of wandering, waving animals. Some are very effective swimmers, and it's just the ones that we're most familiar with, the ones that we see in large blooms and that clog power plant pipelines and things, and the ones that we notice the most are what we'd call these highly efficient oblate cruising predators.
How many kinds of jellyfish are there?
I'm not sure the exact number, but there's at least 1,200 species. So most of the species, the most diverse groups, are rather small, and we never see them. We never notice them. They're within the major group called the Hydrozoa, which are typically smaller groups. The Scyphozoans, which are the ones that we're more familiar with, are not as diverse a group. It's more like on the order of about 100 species around the world.
So there's only about 100 species, but those are the ones we all think of because they're the ones we see all the time.
Yes, they're the ones we typically think of as jellyfish.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest this hour is Dr. Jack Costello of Providence College and MBL. We'll have more intriguing jellyfish facts and stories after a short break. You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. It's probably happened to all of us. You head down to the beach for a nice swim, only to discover the water is teeming with jellyfish. For most of us, that would be an annoyance, an inconvenience. But for my guest today, that experience launched him on a lifelong exploration of jellyfish. Dr. Jack Costello is a professor of biology at Providence College, a Whitman visiting investigator at MBL, and one of the lead investigators on two recently published high-profile studies of jellyfish locomotion. If you want to join my conversation with Jack Costello, you can reach us at 866-999-4626. That's our toll-free phone number. Again, it's 866-999-4626. Now, Jack Costello, what do you remember about your first encounter with jellyfish? I take it you were just a child and literally just wanted to go swimming and were kind of stymied by jellyfish.
Yes, Heather. You know, I like to spend a lot of time in water, and I always have as a kid. The problem for me was when I'd get down to the beach and it would be a beautiful day, but the water would be full of jellyfish.
Like I said, I mean, we've all been there, right?
Yeah, it's just, and there just was not much to do about it. So it became, that was what interested me the most. And I have to admit, when I was a kid, I just threw rocks in them on the beach and when they were washed up and I really hated them. So it has been one of these interests that came from almost a hatred, you know, that I then wanted to know what it was that was causing them to show up. I wanted to find out some, as much as I could, about how I might avoid that, even as a kid. And then I had the opportunity when I was in college to do some independent work looking at, I needed to come up with some topic to work on for a project. And this just struck me as something that I'd always wanted to know something more about. So I started looking at it and looking at the literature on it. What struck me was there wasn't really much of an explanation for what causes jellyfish to suddenly appear and disappear. And so I just became interested in what controlled how they worked.
You know, most of us, I think we go down and I've seen plenty of kids throwing rocks at jellyfish, maybe turn them over, get interested in them. There's a fear. There's maybe a little bit of that dislike or hatred that you talk about, but it never turns into that curiosity.
Yeah. well, you know, some people get curious about spiders or snakes or other things that they have some fear or dislike of, and
a form of facing your fears, perhaps.
Maybe, yeah.
Now, how does what you've learned about jellyfish propulsion and this mechanism of the pulsing movement to bring water in and feed, how does that feed into this, you know, original question you had about why do they bloom and show up where they are? I mean, there's a bit of a connection, right, between the jellyfish's ability to form these large blooms that comes back to this very efficient mechanism of propulsion and feeding.
Yeah, they're all very closely related. And what happened was, at least for me, the more I looked at jellyfish, the more apparent the beauty of how they worked became. And particularly once we started looking at how water flows around them. And so I became involved in trying to understand how their water motions were involved with feeding. And that happened right here in Woods Hole when I was a postdoctoral researcher here. I wasn't working on jellyfish at that point because that's not what the project that I was being paid to work on was involved with. But in capturing some of them while capturing the animals we were looking at, which were copepods, I noticed the process that the jellyfish were using to capture the copepods. And there was sort of an unfortunate consequence of leaving the jellyfish in the same container. You'd come back and everything else would be gone. And it was pretty clear that they were very effective feeders. And as we started looking more at the process of moving water and how they drew water to their capture surfaces, it became clearer that they just were essentially sieving all the prey out of the water.
And I mean, they're almost like ecological vacuum cleaners.
Exactly. And so when you see all these jellyfish swimming through the water and they're just all out in the water, effectively, they're just vacuuming up the available plankton in the water. They're just sucking them in. The ones that are vulnerable to being drawn into those currents are the ones that are all captured. And so so the relationship between how they move and the water that they move is quite important for understanding how they capture prey, and how they capture prey is quite important for understanding their success. That their success depends on being able to do that.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is veteran jellyfish researcher, Dr. Jack Costello. If you want to join our conversation, our phone number is 866-999-4626. Clem is giving us a call from Quissett. No, sorry, we've lost Clem. Clem was there and is no more. But if you would like to join our conversation again, that toll-free number is 866-999-4626. Now, Jack, you were talking about this, you know, the efficiency of being able to move water is there essentially efficiency of being able to suck up food. And we mentioned earlier this diversity of jellyfish that we don't usually think about. It turns out that each jellyfish is able to kind of tailor the way with their movement, what kinds of currents and flow they generate in the water and therefore bring the right kind of food to them. I mean, how different are these different flow patterns that they create, and what, how much selectivity do they have in what they actually bring to them for food?
Well, what we found is that selectivity varies between the species. And so in one area, we looked at a group of coexisting jellyfish, several different species that were all living in the same place with the same food availability out in at a great lab called Friday Harbor in Puget Sound, Washington. What we found were the ones that were ambush predators, that is the ones that sit and wait and leave their tentacles deployed, tended to have more diverse diets. And the ones that were cruisers that swam constantly, drew prey in by feeding currents, tended to have pretty similar overlapping diets. They also tended to eat each other. A number of these jellyfish prey on each other. So the diversity of diets reflects how the animals capture prey. And you can kind of, it sort of makes sense. And if you think spider webs have different gap sizes between the web components and all, the ones that are ambush predators can control which prey they capture with their tentacle deployment, whereas the cruisers are pretty much capturing whatever can get swept in. And that tends to be the same for most of the cruising species.
Hmm. All right. Clem is back on the line now. If you want to give us a call, the number again is 866-999-4626. Clem, you're on the air. What's on your mind this morning?
Good morning, Heather. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Thanks for coming into town. What are the little guys that, like sometimes in the harbor or on Buzzards Bay, you jump in the water and the water's totally saturated with, feel like you're swimming through jello.
Oh, okay. Is it during the summer?
Yes.
Okay. Now, it's highly likely those are tenophores, which become more numerous around early midsummer, early to midsummer, and stay until October-ish. And they become extremely dense. They're a different animal phyla, but they're also gelatinous. That is, tenophores are, they don't have stinging cells, right? You don't get stung by them.
Right. You just feel like you're pushing through, like congealing something or other.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Those also are great predators of plankton. They capture prey differently than the medusae do. They don't have stinging cells. Instead, they have what are called colloblasts that are sticky cells. So things run into them, and they have these sticky cells and mucus, and they capture them. They can become extremely dense, and that's why it feels like you're swimming through a pile of lumpy mucus sometimes.
Exactly. No danger ingesting any of that stuff?
No. They're for us, they're totally harmless.
Clem, if you want a great experience, try swimming in that at night.
Could I just say something to the professor?
Sure.
I'm class of 74 PC, go Friars.
Great.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Sure, thank
you. All right,
thanks. Bye now.
Now, Jack, do you now, as a jellyfish researcher, ever go and swim with jellyfish, get in the water with jellyfish, presumably the non-stinging types, and I guess have a different relationship, less of that hatred than you did when you were a child?
Oh, we spend a lot of time in the water with them because fundamentally how we know the way these animals work comes from being in the water and seeing them in nature in the first place. So, and we have developed some of our laboratory methods, for example, a technique we call particle image velocimetry, so that we can take it underwater and try and look at how animals work in their world. So we use that and some other methods, including just simple observation to try and understand how these animals work.
It seems like that could be a very, I don't know, almost zen, very contemplative experience, meditative experience, to be in the water with all of these gently pulsating, transparent organisms.
It can be, depending on the environment, it can be beautiful. It also can be trying, though, because we've got a lot bigger bodies than they do. And so to try and see things and operate on the same scale as they are often requires us maneuvering and filming. So as we film, it can be somewhat demanding work to try and be as still or move in the same framework that they do. But it is really fun, and it's you really learn a lot by being in the world that they are in.
You know, we just last week spoke with Christoph Ermscher, who's written a biography of Louis Agassiz. And I was struck, you have in previous interviews actually quoted Louis Agassiz saying, study nature, not books. This idea of just what you can learn by getting out there and getting in the water with these organisms. Obviously, there's an aspect of needing to bring them into the laboratory to do other experiments as well. But,
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the controlled laboratory environment is great because it allows you to do some things at a resolution you can't in the field. But it's our field work that instructs us as to what is even worth considering important to look at in the laboratory.
I'm talking with Dr. Jack Costello about his jellyfish research. Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. And Brian is giving us a call from Yarmouth. Hello, Brian.
How you doing there?
We're doing great. Good. How are you?
Pretty good. Monday.
It is.
I just wanted to call. I mean, I've seen a couple of things about jellyfish, and they're actually pretty fascinating. I know it seems like you can't really get your head around the fact that they're more just like they're little blobs, but I mean, some of them are pretty big and they move pretty quick, and they have looks like they got 6 feet of tentacles, and they have a lot of them actually have eyes or multiple eyes too. So they're not just like mindless blobs like floating. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's, and it's interesting you bring up that question of eyes, and all have some type of photosensors, but there's the group, the cubomedusae, that are believed to have image-forming eyes in the sense that they have lenses. Part of the difficulty there has always been, well, how can you have a complex eye without a brain to interpret all that information? And frankly, we're not sure how that all works.
So they actually can create essentially an image, a picture. How do we even know that they can do that?
Well, I think some of them actually, especially the larger ones, they hunt, because like they'll see prey, and they'll start to float in that direction to make sure that they capture even like, you know, whole like fish, you know what I mean, in their tentacles, and then they drag it up into the plume.
Well, and is this part of what you were saying, Jack, earlier about the fact that they can avoid a fish? Do they sense the fish visually and move away from it?
Well, some of this group, the cubomedusae, are very powerful swimmers comparatively, and are known to live in some rather complex environments. For example, around mangrove roots, which are very complex, three-dimensional environments, and they navigate between those with using these eye sensors to distinguish shapes and move around them. How much they can actually resolve what the actual quality of the image is, we don't really know that.
Thanks for your call, Brian.
Right on. Have a good one.
So you're mentioning the cubomedusae. Are these the box jellyfish that we've heard of that are, I mean, they're deadly. Their sting
some
can be
are,
deadly.
Some are quite deadly.
Is there any correlation between kind of having this more directed movement, perhaps more visual sense, if we can call it that, and perhaps being a more toxic jellyfish as opposed to those that are maybe more just the drifting type and sucking in food and don't necessarily need to sting things?
I've never seen that kind of direct correlation between the visual acuity of cubomedusae and toxicity. The cubomedusae, though, are unique in a number of ways. They're a lineage that diverged from the other jellyfish lineages long ago. And they have just some very unique characteristics. The way they swim is different than some of the other groups, although they have very similar muscle structure and all. The development of their visual capabilities is unusual. Their life history is unusual. So they just are somewhat different. But they can be very effective swimmers. Many of them are very effective fish predators. And so a really interesting group. Not that numerous. There's not that many species, but fascinating group with some different characteristics.
This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. With me this hour is Dr. Jack Costello. Coming up, we'll talk about designing jellyfish-like robots and finding features jellyfish share with flies and whales. That's after a short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Imagine swimming in the ocean on a summer afternoon only to come face-to-face with a jellyfish. Now, imagine that jellyfish is 5.5 feet wide, 170 pounds, and a robot. It's not just science fiction. With funding from the Navy, engineers at Virginia Tech have built just such a robotic jellyfish. It's called Cryo, and you can see a video of it on our website, capeandislands.org. Cryo, in part, builds on the research of my guest today, Dr. Jack Costello. He's a professor of biology at Providence College, a Whitman visiting investigator at MBL, and a jellyfish researcher of 25 years. Jack Costello, a giant robotic jellyfish. What's the point?
Well, here's how I think that the whole design of a jellyfish robot got started. If you consider that jellyfish have been, were probably some of the earliest swimmers on the planet and some of the most efficient in terms of swimming, the design for the the jellyfish robot comes from those very efficient swimmers. And so when considering a robotic vehicle in this case, how might you minimize energy expenditure and therefore maximize the amount of time the vehicle could be deployed without having to refuel? That's part of the theme behind it. So if you take the most efficient swimmers and use those as a model, it then seems quite logical to try and develop a jellyfish robot.
But as we were talking about earlier, you know, the most efficient ones, the most efficient swimmers among the jellyfish tend to be the least proficient. They have this very efficient mechanism of moving water, but they don't actually go much of anywhere. So you've got a robot that's highly efficient at going nowhere. So what is it actually going to do? I mean, is the point of it to sit there and suck water in and collect water? Is it a scientific sampling robot? Or what might a robot like this do? Or is that still not really determined? This is just an exercise in seeing what we can create in terms of robotics.
Well, it's a little of both, okay, in the sense that if you really want to get someplace efficiently, torpedoes are really good. I mean, if you want to get someplace very effectively, rapidly. But in the ocean, there's more than just moving from moving, say, horizontally along an area. There's a number of important functions that don't require rapid, proficient motion. For example, you can maintain position pretty effectively often by vertical migration and moving between layers of water that are moving horizontally in different directions. So a robotic vehicle based on cruising medusae is unlikely to be one of the most proficient, most rapidly swimming devices. But that doesn't mean it can't be used to deploy, maintain sensors, and even maintain station in an area depending upon currents. I think a lot of that depends upon the current structure.
So the Navy has paid for some of this robotics development. Is the idea then that it could be out there essentially spying? Maybe one of the things that it's collecting and out there for a long time doing is collecting imagery?
Well, it could be, but I have to tell you, the Navy was wonderful at the outset of this project because they said, effectively, don't try and figure out what we're going to do or what we want with this. Try and discover and just try and find the newest, best information you can from us, and we'll use it. We'll sort out what we can do with it, but we just want you to discover. And that was a great mandate for us.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking this hour with Dr. Jack Costello about his jellyfish locomotion and feeding research. Jack, we have an email here from Henry and Jane asking, do jellyfish have any commercial value, presumably other than any value of these robots based on jellyfish?
Oh, well, for a long time, they've had commercial value as a fishery in Asian countries. We don't value that in the United States, but it's more of a cultural distinction. There's well-developed jellyfish fisheries in Asian countries, China, South Korea, Taiwan, a number of areas. So, yes, there's commercial value, perhaps not to us, but to other people, yeah.
Right. Now, we were talking about this robot Cryo, but there's actually another robot that you can find on the internet. I believe that the New York Times had a video. They called it a flying jellyfish. Mm. And this kind of had four basically wings and kind of fluttered through the air in the kind of what we think of as a jellyfish motion, where it kind of, you know, would bounce up and fall back a little and bounce up and fall back a little the way a pulsing jellyfish does. I mean, have you seen that? And does that strike you as being a true derivative of a jellyfish as far as a robot's concerned?
Well, I did look at it because I found it a really fascinating study. And from my understanding of the researchers' statements. They essentially said that they were trying to solve equilibrium motion as simply as possible, and that this was a design that would do it. And it ends up looking like a jellyfish. And that was true. To me, there were some distinctions in that it looked almost like a four-winged structure with a balanced wing design. So there were some similarities. To me, some fundamental differences as well.
So what are some of those differences? What about it is not jellyfish-like?
I think the four separate structural elements as opposed to one uniform bell that works together is one distinction in my mind.
And you think that's a fundamental aspect?
To me, that's
a
rather
jellyfish.
Fundamental one, because in essence, that meets the four wings. Well, I view them as four separate wings as opposed to one continuous surface.
Now, some of your most recent research has revealed that there are, in fact, striking similarities between the jellyfish bell and other propulsion mechanisms, or, right. or the wings, the tails, the fins that other animals use to swim or to fly, and in particular this flexible edge that you could almost, when you're looking at a jellyfish, think that it's an accident, or just that the edge happens to just kind of flop around. But it turns out that's a really key feature of how efficient they are, and that's shared with many other animals.
Yeah, and this finding came about through work with our colleagues from Virginia Tech when they were building the first designs of a jellyfish. And we started out going, well, the idea is just really to move this continuous surface back and forth. And the initial designs were rigid. They had joints, but they were rigid. And it really didn't work. And Alex Villanueva, the lead, at that point, graduate student building this, attached a flexible silicon margin to it. That is just this layer of flexible material around the edge, and with essentially the same power supply, converted a jellyfish prototype that really didn't swim into one that swam quite effectively. And then further work along those lines led to essentially that large vehicle cryo that you've talked about. So what we found was that having that flexible component without even additional power yielded huge performance differences. And so the next question was, well, how flexible? Where do you put it? If a little edge works, wouldn't a big edge work even better? And we really couldn't resolve that, and we looked at the literature, and there's a pretty developed literature. But instead, we decided to go back to nature and look at actual organisms. And that's where our students got involved and really looked through vast amount of videos just available on the web and started charting out patterns and found a very universal pattern in where propulsive structures, whether they're wings, fishtails, whale flukes, where they bend and how much they bend under constant motion. And that's what we refer to as some of the bending rules for animal propulsor design. So that's how that all came about.
Now, I mean, when we're talking about these similarities between mm-hmm. jellyfish, birds, flies, whales, this is not something that comes from a shared genetic origin, right? This is, as you were mentioning at the very beginning of our conversation, mm-hmm. this is an example of convergent evolution where all of these different animals have somehow come to the same solution independently.
Exactly. It's not as if nature couldn't use rigid designs. We have bones, there's rigid shells, but that's not what characterizes natural propulsive designs. What characterizes natural propulsive designs are flexible structures and what has been curious is that the bending patterns are rather universal among all these different groups, whether they're internal skeletons like vertebrates, external skeletons like insects, what we call hydrostatic or fluid-filled skeletons like some invertebrates. The structural system doesn't seem to matter, yet the end result of where they bend and how much they bend is very similar. So they've converged from very different origins to similar solutions in this regard. It's not like a feather looks like a fin of a bird, but it of a fish, but it bends in some similar ways. That's what has been converged upon, that solution from groups that are not connected very closely phylogenetically and are structurally very different. They've converged on a similar solution, and that's why we call it convergent evolution.
Did that finding surprise you of just how widespread this kind of flexible edge, these bending rules were?
We found it very surprising. It wasn't something that we expected at all. We initially were just looking for some kind of indices to give to engineers for designing a flexible structure. Once we knew that that was important, we said, okay, well, what kind of design criteria can we use? And we thought that it would be variable for depending on size. We thought it would vary in water versus air in different groups. When we found that it was really rather universal across air, water, across different sizes of groups, we found that it was surprising. It was remarkably surprising, yeah.
Now, you've studied a lot of different jellyfish and in some cases very small jellyfish. Do you have a favorite among the thousand or so jellyfish that are out there?
I like a lot of the ones that are really right in our area. There's one small Hydromedusa that I really like, and I have to admit, I guess this won't breach any real security issues for me because I've used it as a password in things in a number of cases. Rathkia. It's one that is quite small. It probably in the water right about now. It starts becoming frequent. It can become really numerous, but it's only a few millimeters, and it buds more jellyfish off a jellyfish, which is sort of an unusual thing, but happens in Hydromedusae often. It will, from one jellyfish, it will just keep budding more jellyfish. Really beautiful animals. So I like a lot of the local species.
Jack Costello, thank you.
Thank you, Heather. Appreciate it.
It's Jack Costello, professor of biology at Providence College, a Whitman visiting investigator at MBL, and jellyfish researcher extraordinaire. Thanks all for listening. This is Living Lab. You can find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Until next week, I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.